Ministry.
Just like a fascist empire would normally behave, another unilateral move by the United States once more promises to affect lives of people around the world for the worse, this time in terms of internet freedom. In an expected move on Tuesday, June 22nd, the U.S. Justice Department seized 36 websites with links to the Islamic Republic of Iran and its regional allies for engaging in, quote, disinformation campaigns and malign influence operations, unquote. The move initially arose suspicions of a hack since a disclaimer that said this website has been seized accompanied an Arabic text as the one you can still see on PressTV.com, while State Department spokesman Ned Price refused to comment. The Empire's Justice Department eventually said three of the seized domains belonged to the Iraqi group Kata'ib Hezbollah, while the rest, including Yemeni, Palestinian, and Bahraini outlets in English and Arabic, were supported by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union. The seized websites obviously belonged to outlets of the allied resistance communities, better known as the Resistance Axis, that Iran supports across the region to counter the influence of the U.S. and regional rivals like Israel and Saudi Arabia. Try to keep a straight face here. The U.S. blacklisted us with designations related to terrorism. I kid you not. The mother of all terrorism, also known as the Empire, said that the American companies are not allowed to provide us with .com and .net domains without special authorization from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC. U.S. fascist officials can choose to label it however they wish, yet they will never be able to change the fact that this seizure is a clear example of a systematic effort to distort freedom of speech on a global level and silence independent voices in media, which gives us and everyone included in this seizure the full right to pursue the issue through legal channels. While the U.S. may have given itself the ability to exert influence over vast sections of the internet, its actions will for sure have far-reaching ramifications beyond its control. Those unilateral harassment actions will only give credence to arguments of U.S. interference and censoring due to fear of being further exposed by native media in nations they continue to sanction like Iran, occupy like Iraq, and bomb like Yemen. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. More than 30 web domains linked to the Axis of Resistance, one of which is PressTV, were blatantly seized by U.S. agencies last week. The U.S. seized sites operated inside Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon, as well as social media channels affiliated with the Iraqi resistance, the PMU. The seizures come as the Biden administration is in the midst of negotiations over Tehran's nuclear program and follow the election of a new president who has been criticized by Washington for being a staunch detractor of its imperial foreign policy. Now, the Iranian government condemned this act of censorship as unlawful and part of an influence campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran. To discuss this issue with us in Beirut is Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media and a tech expert. Thank you very much for being with us, Hadi. Now, visitors of the affected websites by the seizure, by the U.S. Seizure, were greeted with a banner that says that the domain name has been seized by the U.S. government as part of, I quote, enforcement action taken by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Bureau of Industry and Security. Now, if you want to define and maybe phrase this, just put it into words, how would you do that?
First of all, we need to understand one thing, which is that what happened was that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized the DNS side of the website, not the actual site. So it's what tells the when a person browses for a site, he types a name. The DNS service is what tells the browser that this name belongs to this IP address. This link is what the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized. That's basically what happened in the first part.
That would you putting it into actual words, but that actual seizure from a tech point of view, how much time would have that have taken, and what would the tools be that they used to do that?
Since they have access to the actual DNS service from a local company inside the US, which runs these DNS addresses, they can do it easily with one court order. They can directly seize control on anything which is considered on U.S. soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you an Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokeswoman had declared when that happened before? It declared that this act of we can call it internet fascism by the U.S. was performed that by the U.S. government because it has a right to seize the .com, .net, and .org domain names simply because the companies have the contracts to administer them are based on U.S. soil. If that is the case, wouldn't such actions urge people to move away from these domain names to try and at least protect their work?
Well, basically, people should start to understand that since there is no actual real internet governance which is in unbiased hands, they should know that whenever they buy any of these domains, they are susceptible to being seized by the U.S. government. Knowing that, if you want to go to the legal side of it, the U.S. should only be enforcing whatever ends with a .us. So it might be .com, then .us. Or, like, for example, in Lebanon, .com.lb, and whatever other country, .me, for example. It depends on which country. So each country can have access to its own domains if it was the unbiased way to achieve such a thing. But sadly, what's happening is that they have control over all the .com, the .net, even the .org, since the companies that run these domains are on American soil, and VeriSign, which is the company that runs the .com and .nets, is very very closely tied to the system.
You mentioned VeriSign, Hadi, and it's a U.S.-based internet backbone company that has the contract to manage the COVID.com and other generic top-level domains, the ones that you just mentioned, and it has a very cozy relationship, and I mean cozy that's described by the U.S. media, not by me, with the federal government, with the FBI, and has long had a contract from the U.S. government to help manage the internet's root file, which is the key to having a unified internet name system. What would now stop other international corporation for assigned names and numbers from following suit of unleashing a global government crackdown on domain names that simply do not abide by Western values or Western narratives, or just simply are not liked by the US, the UK, or any other Western regime?
Again, sadly, we are at a point where nothing can stop such seizures happening in anywhere in the world, since they have ultimate access to all these things. There's the ICANN, ICANN. They were under American control for some time, and then they released that control, and they started making 13 multiple organizations governing each part of the world. They are non-governmental organization. They don't get paid by any government, and they are one step towards global internet governance, trying to make internet unbiased location. But still, the U.S. hasn't released its hand over these names. So we get to a loop where we are susceptible to have our domains seized at any moment just by being connected to any ideology or any political stance which is maybe anti-US or anti-West, or maybe doesn't go well with US comprehension of things.
Or simply, if you're going to compete with the U.S., we did see that happening to a lot of also Chinese websites where they were seized, they were put down. But I had a technical question concerning something that you mentioned about the .com.lb, for example. Is that more secure from the .com by itself? If I'm going to go with the .com.ir instead of just .com, should that be more safe than just going with the domain name .ir?
Your own country's domain, for example, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there's the .ir, which is governed by Iranian law. It has nothing to do with American governance over the internet. So, of course, it's much safer to invest in your own domain. And maybe if you want, you can link a .com to it for SEO purposes, which later on might have other issues. But that's another tactical path.
So you mean that only having a .ir might make it hard to find it on a search engine?
Yes, true. Because the crawlers work in a different way, and also the search engine itself might be biased. It might push things which aren't actually relevant.
Hello, Google.
Exactly.
Well, many outside the United States, like China, Russia, India, they distrust this U.S. cozy tech companies, especially with the big tech companies, the social media ones, and have been vocal about wanting to see control being shared all across the world, which is just fair, at least to say it's fair, of the internet's naming system. They want to see it turned over to an organization such as the International Telecommunications Union, an affiliate of the United Nations. Now, look. Once you say UN, I, for one, as a citizen of West Asia, I am a bit panicking once I hear the word UN. Why? Because it is an international body, but it's a biased body.
True.
So what are we actually doing here?
Maybe this makes it less susceptible to U.S. seizure, but in the end, it will be biased, but since it presents itself as an unbiased organization, it gives us a range of movement to work with such institutes.
So it might actually protect domain names or might just get them on board a certain committee that would have to study if that domain name
exactly.
is used or not.
It gets them maybe on the side where instead of having, like, for example, you sleep and then you wake up with 30-plus websites being seized, you'll wake up with a warning, and then things will start to take a bit of meetings from here, discussions there, debates here, until they get to a certain...
But wouldn't that just threaten freedom of speech?
At the end of the day, it is
a form of censorship.
Exactly. That's what's happening.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media, for explaining to us what actually happened when the U.S. blatantly decided to take over our websites and the websites of our sister channels as well. Thank you very much for being with us. It was great content from you, Hadi. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what is going on in the occupied West Bank.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Seems that death in Palestinian authority custody no longer differs than that of the Israeli occupation's use of ruthless excessive force against Palestinians during incarceration, and that's being said sadly. An outspoken critic of the Palestinian Authority who intended to run in the parliamentary elections before they were actually canceled earlier this May died during his arrest in Hebron by Palestinian Authority forces on Thursday. Nizar Banat, 44 years old, was a harsh critic of the Palestinian Authority, which governs part of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, and called on Western nations to cut off aid to it because of its growing authoritarianism and human rights violations. More in this following report.
Hundreds of Palestinian natives continue to gather on a daily basis in the city of Ramallah to protest over the death of activist Nizar Banat after being dragged by excessive force out of his home on Thursday, June 24th at 3:30 a.m. in the morning by the Palestinian Authority security forces. Angry demonstrators gathered in the city of Ramallah, the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority, to chant slogans against President Mahmoud Abbas 2 days after Abbas's forces arrested and killed activist Nizar Banat. They carried Palestinian flags, photos of Banat, and signs demanding the fall of the regime. Protests were also held in Hebron and El Bire. Palestinian security forces then launched a heavy barrage of tear gas into the crowd of hundreds in Ramallah and attacked protesters and several journalists. Earlier, plainclothes security forces spread out among protesters as they marched from the center of Ramallah towards the presidential offices and closed off the intersection leading to the area, forcing shops to close. One video from the protest showed security forces in plain clothes dragging a protester across the road as they simultaneously beat him.
القيادة الفلسطينية التقليدية هذه اللي حكمت الضفة الغربية اليوم طول عمرها هيك بتتاجر بكل شيء.
But who is Banat and why is his death, which some is now dubbing as an assassination, so significant? The prominent Palestinian political activist and an advocate of free speech was known for his outspoken videos on social media criticizing the Palestinian Authority for its corruption, as well as its shameful security coordination with the Israeli occupation forces in the occupied West Bank. A former member of the Farah movement himself, the de facto ruling party of the Palestinian Authority, Banat had been campaigning as a candidate for legislative elections on the Freedom and Dignity list. The elections initially scheduled for May were postponed by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in April. While Abbas cited the voting rights of Palestinians living in occupied East Al-Quds as a reason to push back the elections, critics have accused him of seeking excuses to avoid a vote due to his party's unpopularity. Banat was well known for his extensive knowledge of Palestinian political and social history, often recalling anecdotes about the Palestinian Liberation Organization PLO in the 1970s or the British Mandate of Palestine before 1948 in order to make his point. In May, bullets, stun grenades, and tear gas were fired at the Banat family home while his wife and children were inside. Banat accused ruling party Fatah of being behind the attack and called on the European Union to cut its financial aid to the Palestinian Authority. Banat had also accused the Palestinian Authority of perpetrating torture on political dissidents detained in its prisons. Hence, his sudden death while in the hands of the Palestinian Authority sparked outrage and dismay in the Palestinian streets, which many believe has triggered the inevitable downfall of the Palestinian Authority.
So with us to discuss this issue is Mr. Ali Murad, who's a political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, just like that, a brief statement was given by the Hebron Governorate saying that Nizar Banat's health deteriorated while he was in custody when Palestinian forces arrested him from his house earlier on Thursday, and that he was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. This is definitely not the first case where we see a detainee dying while in custody of the Palestinian Authority security forces. However, this man was known to have faced direct threats from members of the Palestinian Authority. How come this matter escalated to a point that whoever arrested him ended up just murdering him?
Thank you for hosting me. Of course, martyr Nizar Banat was threatened nearly on a daily basis. He had told his friends and his family that he is receiving death threats weeks before the assassination took place. Nizar's problem is that he was outspoken. He never, ever was able to louder his voice when talking about the corruption of the Palestinian Authority and all the security apparatus that Mahmoud Abbas rules the West Bank using it. So Nizar Banat, I think, was the man who had the bravery and all the strength that many others lack. He used his voice to speak. He never held a gun to shoot at the security forces or any member of the Palestinian Authority, All he had, his voice, his bravery, talking about what is wrong, the corruption, the security coordination with the Zionist enemy that Mahmoud Abbas is insisting on keeping. So I think other circumstances maybe has led to the assassination of Nizar, because after the battle of the Al-Quds sword, the Palestinian Authority sensed that the popularity, its popularity is going down. So
Mr. Ali, before I even contacted you to come and be our guest speaker, I spoke with four different Palestinian natives living in the West Bank who canceled right after actually saying, yes, we'd be happy to talk about Nizar, but they canceled because they were afraid that they would be incarcerated
exactly.
themselves. So it's a real police state there.
Exactly.
And as you said, Nizar didn't even have a weapon to defend himself, because weapons are also not allowed because of the coordination, the security coordination with Israel. But in early May, he had gunmen firing bullets, tear
exactly.
gas, grenade, stun grenades at his house while his wife and his children were inside the house. He blamed the attack on Mahmoud Abbas himself and the Fatah party. Now, is there something that could have been done to avert them attacking his house again, or is it just too complicated to talk about it as if it's something that should not happen? Because we don't really have a lot of information coming out of the West Bank.
Exactly. But we have to know something before to answer this, because if you take a look at the history of the relation between Nizar and the security apparatus of Abu Mazen, you'll find out that he was taken into as a detainee for like 10 times or 15 times before. He was beaten. He was at several times his bones were crushed, and still Nizar remained the same. In other ways, Nizar was sending a message that no matter how violent you were in dealing with me, in trying to oppress me, in trying to silence me, I will not be silent. I will remain speaking. He went to run for elections, the elections that Mahmoud Abbas canceled during the last month.
In May, yeah.
Yes. So all the voices that declared that they are against the way that Mahmoud Abbas is ruling regarding the elections and regarding the corruption with the coronavirus vaccines, also with all the security coordination with the Zionist entity.
The goal of the coordination with the Israeli entity, is it he learned from them how to suppress his own people?
Actually, he is getting paid to prevent resistance. This is the main role of the Palestinian Authority. The Oslo Accords made it clear that any authority that the Palestinian Authority to rule in the West Bank, it has to do this to prevent any act of resistance. Now I believe Mahmoud Abbas moved into another step by silencing all the voices. We are not talking about taking guns or putting resistance activists inside jail. We are talking about oppression that is not serving. It's serving the goal of a dictatorship. We are talking about a dictator now. Mahmoud Abbas has turned himself into a dictator. He is no different
options,
than other
Ali,
dictators.
What are the options left for the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank to try and at least fix the situation? We don't want Palestinians fighting one another, but what options do they have?
Because the Palestinian Authority is acting as an agent of the enemy, it left no choice for the Palestinians, for the majority of the Palestinians who want to resist the occupation. They want to liberate their lands. So we are seeing now, since the assassination of Nizar, there are protests taking place in more than one city and in all in many villages in the West Bank.
It's on a daily basis. It's
yes.
not ending.
I think this is the available choice now. maybe there has to be done, something has to be done inside the Fatah movement, because there are free people, there are real patriots in the Fatah movement. They have to rebel against their leadership. They have to change this leadership, because in the era of victories, with the victory that the resistance
achieved
last month, this the way, the same way that Mahmoud Abbas is still ruling is outdated. I believe that
definitely incompatible. Definitely, it's something to really think about and give way for the Palestinians to decide for themselves, obviously. But we hope the best for all our Palestinian brothers in the face of the occupation. Thank you very much, Ali Murad, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about the assassination of Nizar Banat, the Palestinian activist, sadly at the hands of Palestinian Authority security forces. Thank you very much for being with us. And please stay tuned. Next week, we have more for you on the Mideast Stream.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today we're speaking about prophethood and the necessity of prophethood and the divine revelation. In some of our previous sessions, we said that human beings are naturally social beings, and they come together to form societies so that they can secure the need, their things that they need in order for their existence to be sustained and for them to continue living in this world. Because no human being can live alone. No human being can live by himself and hope to hope that his existence will continue in this world. No, he'll eventually die. Every human being has a certain needs, and in order to fulfill these needs, there has to be a distribution of labor. This can only occur if human beings come together and cooperate with one another and distribute labor amongst themselves, and then once this labor and this work is done, and they share the products of their labor with one another, as we see occurring in society today. Obviously, when this occurs, there is a conflict of interest, and every human being tries to secure his own needs, sometimes to the detriment of others. People will try to steal from one another, they'll murder one another, right, and take from one another oppressively. All of this, in order for this conflict, this chaos and this conflict of interest to be resolved, there has to be a law. And we said that the person or the being forming this law has to have a knowledge of the thing and the being that he's forming the law for, in other words, the human being. And we said that the person, the being that has the best knowledge and the most perfect knowledge of human being is God Almighty, who is the creator of this being. Right? Obviously, the person who has created something or has made something knows it in the most perfect and in the best way. It's possible here for somebody to raise the following question and say this, that it's true that we human beings don't know ourselves perfectly. Right? There's a lot of things that we don't know about ourselves. Granted, but why can't we say that we can form laws, right, based upon the limited knowledge that we have, and gradually, as our knowledge of ourselves and our species is perfected, we can alter those laws and change those laws to parallel them and to make them harmonious with the knowledge that we have of ourselves. We can amend laws gradually, as we discover that they're imperfect. when we find out that a law is imperfect and harmful for us based upon our renewed understanding of ourselves, we can change that law and amend it, and in this way rectify our mistakes. We can use a trial and error basis, method in the formation of these laws. What's the problem with that? The problem with that is this, and the answer to this question is this, that this method could be used, and it is used, and it can lead to a gradual perfection of the laws that we're forming. But we have to ask this, what about those human beings that existed beforehand and we harmed by using this method, right? Obviously, those laws in the past that we formed and were to the harm and the detriment of the human beings of the past, we would be responsible for the harm inflicted upon them, right? It's true, the human beings in the future would benefit from the perfect laws that we would form, but what about the human beings of the past? We would be harming them. We would be preventing them from reaching their felicity in this world and in the hereafter. Right, so this method is not a good method for the formation of laws in society. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining prophethood and the necessity of the divine law. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام صلاة الجمعة فريضة والاجتماع إليها فريضة مع الإمام فإن ترك رجل من غير علة ثلاث جمع فقد ترك ثلاث فرائض ولا يدع ثلاث فرائض من غير علة إلا منافق
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated that Friday prayer is an obligation and congregating for it in the presence of an imam is an obligation. So if someone misses three Friday prayers without an excuse, it is as if he has abandoned the performance of three obligations. And none but a hypocrite abandons three obligations without an excuse.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the beautiful and profound conversations of the infallible Imams, namely Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, that he emphasized in many places these moral and ethical manners and behaviors and how a human being should interact with one another, how a human being should behave with another human being in order to create a harmonious, peaceful, and really a utopian society. Now, when talking about these kind of Islamic etiquettes, these akhlaq, this ethics and morality that Islam puts forth in order to create peace and harmony and love across the world, across societies and countries and nations, Imam al-Baqir talks to one of his companions about certain traits which lead to the quickest punishment, because these traits are disliked traits, they are unwanted traits, they are bad characteristics. And so here Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, talking to his companion, says that what is this trait which leads to the quickest punishment? Well, it is when a person who visits his relations, but that relation tries to cut off from them. It's very interesting, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners, but we have a tendency to, at times, not really want to visit our relations, or we want to cut off our relations, or perhaps we just don't want to deal with this person. Now, of course, we're not talking about a relative or relation who is perhaps an oppressor, you know, or is a really evil person. And of course, in this situation, if your relative is a evil person and there is a very high probability that they will also influence you into doing bad things, then yes, you must refrain from meeting that relative. But on the other hand, if you feel that there is a high probability that you will be able to influence your relative to change their ways, then you must try your best to help that relative. Now, cutting off relations in the sense that we are talking about is, for example, when there are these little, you know, small quirks or these small things that bother you about a certain relative. You know, they eat in a strange way, or they talk about strange things, or, you know, they're not very interesting, or maybe they're boring, or they're too old, or they're too young, or they live in a certain part of town. These very lame and useless and vain excuses for not having relations with your relatives, these are not proper excuses, there are not proper reasons for a person to cut off their relations with their relatives. And if you cut off your relations with your relatives, for example, because maybe they're poor, or maybe they live in a certain town, a certain part of the city, or maybe their social status isn't good enough, if you cut off your relations with a relative because of this, this leads, dear friends, to the quickest punishment by Allah. So try your best to have good relations with your relatives, and most especially with that relative who pays attention to you and gives you respect and gives you honor. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. What we're suggesting is that as a community of believers out here, we've got to move towards the process of purifying our understanding. The words of the Imams are pure themselves. Our knowledge of the sayings of the Imam is not pure. We don't purely have the knowledge of the sayings of the Imam. There's a lot of other statements, misinterpretations, mistranslations that we have in our mind as the words of the Ma'sumin. We've got to filter that out. And we've got to use the methodology that the Ahlul Bayt presented, Imam al-Baqir presented, the part of it that we can start with and inshallah progress and move forward with, get to more details, and everyone can move towards this notion that hadith books are strictly for the ulama is not correct. Imam al-Sadiq mentioned a lot of what he mentioned in an audience of average people. It's recorded in a book. Why is that hadith restricted for ulama? It's not. Books of hadith should be books that everyone goes. It's nur. The majority, 90%+ of our hadith are reliable. Go and read those hadith yourselves. We should get to that point. We should learn the Arabic language. We should have translations. It's important for those who can engage in translating these with utmost care, of course. Utmost care, to the best of our ability. And anything beyond our ability is not our taklif. If I can't understand any more than this, this is what I understand. This is the best translation I can offer. I did my best, but this is not the word of the Imam. This is my understanding. I'm presenting it. It's better than not presenting it.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
All those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How
much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasir Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. One of the things that we should really pay attention to when we want to read a book or pick up a particular book that looks at a particular topic, if we should
look at the time frame in which that book was written in. The book that we would like to introduce today to our dear listeners has that particular condition on it, because the book and the person who rather gave the lecture by which the book is based on was, you know, a long time ago, and a lot of things have changed since then, both in the country that this person spoke in. Therefore, we see it not only has a particular time specific, it is also place specific. This is one of the most important things that we should understand, that not every book is general. Not every book can be applied everywhere else. This book is for a particular time, for a particular group of people. Yes, it does not mean that general principles cannot be extracted from it, but it requires more effort and more assistance to see that can these particular principles be applied to other places. And also the author, the views of the author, the academic background of the author, and so on and so forth, need also to be understood in his worldview. What is he trying to portray to us? So in the book, rather, which is a lecture that was given by the person or the author at a particular time, which was then translated into English, will be the subject of our next segment, inshallah. Please stay tuned until then.
They say, oh poor girl, you're so beautiful, you know. So lift the veil from your heart to see the heart of purity. Lift the veil from your heart to see the heart of purity. Lift the veil from your heart and seek the heart of purity.
Welcome back to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. With me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Currently, we are discussing the book Our Expectations on the Muslim Woman by Dr. Ali Shariati, and the book has been translated by Lale Bakhtiar, who recently passed away. So this particular book, or rather it's a booklet, it's a lecture that the author, Dr. Shariati, it doesn't say exactly where he gave it, but it is a lecture which was therefore then translated into English, and it was printed into three parts. And the text discusses women's rights, the personality, and so on and so forth. And it tries to therefore give practical lessons and practical advice on this issue of women's rights, women's, for example, social relationships, children's rights, family rights, and so on and so forth. Like I said, this book is time-specific. A lot of these things that the author has mentioned has already been discussed and has changed. Because if you have to look at where we are today, in the year 2021, this book is nearly 50 to 60 years old, if not more, this lecture that was given by the particular author. Hence, it may not be as relevant as we see to be. So anyway, the author here obviously speaking at that particular time, obviously being at the time before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, maybe during a time of turmoil. It is not said exactly when the speech was given, as I mentioned, nor does it say when it was given. And it speaks about things that, you know, speak about certain traditional and cultural things that had or were occurring in Iran at that particular time. And then how is a person then able to change this and make it more Islamic in terms of Islamic upbringing, Islamic social relationships, and so on and so forth. And as I mentioned again, what is the author's definition of Islam? What does he mean by Islam? And all these type of things need to be acquired from the other books that the author may have. For as we know that Dr. Shariati was a socialist, was a person, what I mean by socialist, a person who was very socially active. A social activist is maybe a better word. But he was not a person who studied Islam in the Hausa or a traditional Hausa system. But this book, inshallah, may be beneficial to certain individuals who want to see as a historical background what the conditions of women were before the Islamic Revolution and after. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a part of this lecture, rather, from Dr. Shariati. Please stay tuned.
The Quran names several chapters in honor of women. Al-Nisa, or the woman, is one chapter. Or as the late Sheikh Ahmad Kuftaro taught, in defense of women. This chapter conveys many subjects regarding women's affairs and rights. Another chapter in the Quran devoted to women is named Al-Mujadila, or the woman with plea. There is yet another chapter in the Quran named Mary, after the Virgin Mary, mother of Jesus. These chapters constitute a giant step in the liberation of women from the earlier beliefs of superstition. Men shall have a share of what their parents and kinsmen leave. Women shall have a share of what their parents and kinsmen leave. Whether it be little or much, it is legally theirs. Quran 4:7.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program, Bookshelf on IRIB, English Radio. We have been discussing the book, or rather the lecture that was translated into English by Dr. Ali Shariati, known as Our Expectations on the Muslim Woman, that was translated by Lale Bakhtiar. So in the beginning of the book, in the very first chapters, the doctor speaks and mentions this. Prior to beginning my lecture, I would like to propose some practical suggestions. Speaking about women's rights, women's personality, and Islam's view of women differs a great deal from the realization of the actual value which Islam gives to human beings and to women in particular. Often we are satisfied by pointing out that Islam gives great value to science or establishes progressive rights for women. Unfortunately, we never actually use or benefit from these values or rights. We could benefit from these if we were to act according to the understanding which we acquire from them. Many people are acquainted with Islamic views of society, social relations, women's rights, children's rights, and family rights. But these same people tend to follow non-Islamic, ancient cultural traditions and do not dare to base their lives upon Islamic values. That is, they do not practice what they preach. Thus, we always remain at the level of talking. We must complete Islamic views and intellectual discussions with practical solutions. We must find a way whereby we reach these values and rights in practice. After proposing my views, the question should be asked, how can we actually put them into practice? Throughout history, the problem of women's rights and their role has always been considered to be an intellectual problem. Hence, various religious, philosophical, and social systems have reached varying views in this respect. Inshallah, my dear brothers and sisters, until our next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. We invite you to listen to a short speech by Dr. Shomali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-Aliyyil Azim. Zikr is turning with your heart to God. But what does it mean to turn your heart towards God? Does it mean to think of God? Does it mean to remember God, to believe in God? What is to turn towards God with your heart? In order to explain why, what is this, we have to explain what is not dhikr, so it becomes clearer. Imagine shaitan is all the time remembering God, but in a negative way, because he's enemy and he wants to do everything in order to misguide people. So he's remembering all the time God and, you know, worshippers in God, places that belong to, you know, worship, to service, to religion. So he's all the time, you know, an enemy is always thinking about harming. By the way, you must know that Allah is not enemy of shaitan. Shaitan is enemy of human beings, and because of human beings, enemy of God. But Allah is not enemy of shaitan. If in linguistically, sometimes, you know, people use this, they have to be aware that Allah is not enemy of anyone. Enmity is from the other side, but as a, you know, bab e mufa'ala, maybe if someone, you know, is going to use it, that's different. But shaitan is too little that Allah would, you know, have enmity towards shaitan. And having enmity towards creature, you know, his own creature, doesn't seem that it's possible. Allah is much, much higher than having enmity with anyone. They have enmity with him, yes. He has adov, but Allah is not adov of anyone. Allah wants the best for everyone. It's the other way. In any case, an enemy is always thinking about harming. Amir al-Mu'mineen, for example, says, "Man nama lam yunam an." Even if you sleep, your enemies are not going to sleep about you. You know, an, it means thinking about harming you, planning. So is this dhikr? Is this dhikr? Can we say enemies do dhikr? In Arabic language, maybe. You can say, Al-A'da da'iman yadhkurunana fi mukhattatatihim fi baramijihim. In Arabic language, it makes sense. But in Quranic sense, no. In Quranic sense, dhikr should be positive remembrance. Only mu'minin among human beings do dhikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not Satan and not bad people who want to harm. If someone develops hatred, for example, towards God and religion, or, you know, religious people, and, you know, day and night is working about, you know, attacking God and proving that God doesn't exist. Yes, all the time he's busy with this, but we don't call that he is doing dhikr of God. In the Quranic sense, dhikr is to be turning with your heart towards God with positivity, which means you open your heart for God. Not that you close your heart so that God doesn't come in. You know, sometimes I remember someone and I don't want him to come to my home, so I watch the door, you know, lock the door, look, you know, at the door so that he wouldn't come inside my home. Sometimes I want very much someone to come. I open my door and, you know, I say, you know, please come in. أَفَمَنْ شَرَحَ اللَّهُ الصَّدْرَ